Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week. I'm Kerry Weber here with Tim Reedy, and we are now switching gears to talk with Padraig O'Tooma. But first, we also want to mention a little program that will be coming up on Sirius XM. It's a conversation between actually myself and Father James Martin and Father Matt Malone on the topic of where the church is going. It's a conversation that was recorded here in New York City at St. Ignatius Loyola Parish. And it's going to be on at February 2nd at 2 p.m., 4 p.m., and 9 p.m. Eastern. So you can listen to it then and hear about where the church is going.
Yeah, and we also have the video available online, so you can watch it.
You can watch it now if you want. You can do both.
Don't say that.
Yeah, wait till the show is over to go watch it. But now, you won't want to go watch that now because we have a wonderful guest, Padraig O'Tooma, who is a poet, a theologian, he works in sort of conflict resolution and dialogue. He's from the Republic of Ireland and now lives in Northern Ireland. And he works at a group called at a community called Corrymeela. So, Padraig, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
And it's serendipitous that you're also a poet. We just had a poet on the air.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of Mary Carr. Sinner's Welcome is probably one of my favorite books of last year. I know it's older than that, but I only discovered her work last year.
I have read
it over and over. There's a lovely line in one of them where she talks about a teacher of hers coming and touching her book like a bad fairy's wand. And I just love that line. I can't stop but smile. I can't but smile whenever I read it.
Well, that is wonderful. Now, I wonder, let's start with a bit of your own work. This Corrymeela, it's not a word that's probably familiar to most Americans. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the organization, the community does and is, and then also a little bit about the word itself.
Yeah. So Corrymeela is a community that started in 1965. We're just coming to the end of our 50th anniversary. And Corrymeela was begun by Reverend Ray Davey, who was a Presbyterian minister. He had been a volunteer padre in the Second World War and actually was incarcerated in prisoner of war camps for 5 years. And he saw humanity's capacity for inhumanity in Dresden. And he saw the annihilation of Dresden as well and came back. And as tensions were rising in Belfast, he became aware of the ways within which enmity was betraying all. So he was chaplain in Queens by that stage. And so he, together with some students, they bought some property on the very north coast of Ireland, a place called Corrymeela. It's actually just the townland name, 4 or 5 fields on a cliff a mile outside Ballycastle on the North Antrim coast. And they renovated the house that was there. There was a big old house. And they made it as a place of pilgrimage and political dialogue and religious dialogue for people who were in other ways being led into enmity. And this was 1965 and the Troubles broke out in 68, 69. And so Corrymeela had been around for a few years at that stage as a place of pilgrimage and welcome for people not to diminish their differences, but to find a way of holding your differences in a way that isn't destructive.
Right. So. It's very prescient in a lot of ways.
Yeah, totally. And it has continued to be so. There was 30 years then of violence during which 3,600 people were murdered and 50,000 people were directly injured. And then about 500,000 people were affected by grief, which is 1 out of every 3 of the population of Northern Ireland. And so it became really a place, a vital place of dialogue. So many people who were perpetrators and victims of those incidences met each other there. Corrymeela is a community, and so hospitality and welcome and shared washing up and cups of tea and making your bed at the end of your stay is part of the whole thing. It isn't just a conference centre. We have a lived community there who are there year-round, and it's a really important thing for us that welcome and hospitality are at the beginning of political negotiation and dialogue.
That makes sense. Yeah. Tea makes everything better.
Tea makes every buckets of tea. I'm glad to hear you think that.
Yeah. So we're looking basically since, the first 30 years or so, you had the Troubles, and it's a big part of what you did. But kind of continuing the work of the peace process over the last 15, 20 years, I mean, that process isn't over. It's still continuing in many ways, I imagine.
Yeah, so it's 18 years now since the peace accords were signed in 1998 under Senator George Mitchell's leadership.
Who was on
guidance.
The show.
Yeah, and he spoke at our event in the Irish consulate last week as well. He's an extraordinary man. Corrymeela all the time had support as well as giving support to other zones of conflict around the world, Israel and Palestine, South Africa, the Balkans, and that work has continued as well. So a colleague of mine is going to Sri Lanka in a few weeks to do some work there. We are currently doing a partnership with the United States Institute for Peace for some of their work in training leaders in South Sudan in terms of incorporating religious and political aspirations in terms of what local peace means and how is it that you bring those aspirations into dialogue and into ways of communities that are at war with each other and falling apart, and some people who appreciate a border and some people who hate a border. How is it that you live in these situations where new borders are put in a way that doesn't mean you're destroying each other in the name of your ideology about the border, whether you support it or not? And that's happening worldwide, and in a certain sense Northern Ireland can be a beacon of light for what it can mean to live in a place where there is a border that we know some love and some hate, but finding a way to say, nonetheless, how do we live with each other here? Whether or not the border remains permanent is a secondary question. The primary question is, how do we live with each other? Because the only alternative to that is annihilation, and that is the defeat of us all.
And the Irish story, I mean, it's still a difficult story, but it's largely a success story. And that's why I'm sure many people visit you to learn about, well, how did you do this?
Yeah, so we've got around 10,000 visitors a year to Corrymeela. And 18 years later, there are a few too many murders, which is a few in comparison to one a day. Now we're looking at a few a year, which is extraordinarily painful for the families involved. And the work is really to diminish that. We also have a situation where there are ongoing levels at which divisions are continuing, but are so isolated in certain senses that it can be hard to realize the enormous difference between what was and what is. And it is demonstration that on every level, education, economics, community work, policy work and faith work, that there needs to be cooperation and sharing between all the actors in that sense to look at what an integrated society means. But that's painful. Peace is painful, but the alternative is deadly. And that's what we have to think. There's this idea that once a peace accord is signed, we've arrived at the end, when actually all we've done is arrive at the beginning. And the pain continues. Pain doesn't end with the beginning of peace. Peace is a deliberate conviction. Peace is like prayer in a certain sense. It's not like you pray and then it's done. Prayer is a continuing examine of your life, a continuing way of being attentive to what's happening in your life. You have to nurture and attend to prayer. And peace is the same thing, and you have to keep it alive if it's going to flourish. Otherwise, it can turn into something that it brings in entitlement.
Right. And there's a process to it. And this process of sort of looking back and looking forward at the same time, which I imagine in some ways can be exhausting as well.
Yeah. Well, I was listening with great interest to what you were speaking with Mary Carr about earlier on in terms of memory, to look back. And what truth are you going to take from the past? Because it's a complicated thing, the past. Emily Dickinson, the great American poet, says the past is a curious creature. And how do you begin the past? Where do you begin? If you say to people in Northern Ireland, when do the Troubles begin? Some might say 1969 in a road in West Belfast. Somebody else will say 1607 with the arrival of the English. And where do you begin the story of the past? And the way that you begin indicates the ways within which you see perpetrator and victim today, which then dictates the way you see the future. And that's a really complicated thing. And when people's lives are affected, a woman I met recently who's a member of the Corrymeela community, her husband was murdered in the 70s. And she said, look, it's coming up to the anniversary this week. And she said, some anniversaries are easy. This one isn't. And you just thought, 40 years later, and that doesn't go away. And you would never, ever critique a person for living well, living with their grief. And she lives well with her grief because she speaks about it and she says what it's like. But that's never easy. Never, never easy. The alternative is worse. The alternative is deadly. But it is never easy to live with that and to turn to the past and find a way where the past can inform the moment of courage now in a way that can lead you into the future. Because the alternative to that is moments of revenge and moments of difficulty and moments where you feel yourself being drawn back and only guided and imprisoned by the past. And I think that can't be the way that we live with ourselves.
Now, in the case of the Troubles, obviously, you had two Christian communities. I mean, they obviously were very much opposed, but did it help that they shared that kind of tradition of the gospel? Were there stories that could be drawn from there that kind of helped the conversation?
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. Because there is so little shared between the two communities, and obviously there's many communities in Northern Ireland, but we traditionally talk about the two communities. You know, one will say they're British, one will say they're Irish, one will say we're in Northern Ireland, the other will say we're in the north of Ireland, etc. But the Gospels were the joint common heritage and the joint sacred text within that. So the Gospels were an extraordinary place of gathering together. Obviously, the cosmetics of worship can seem so different that it's another way for worship to seem foreign to each other. But I do think practices of Lectio Divina and practices where you simply gather around the text and find a way calmly and kindly to speak about your love of the text can really open that up. And the Gospel text, that's my particular study. I did a master's in the Gospel of Mark. And I'm really interested in how the marginalized characters are often the heroes of those texts. Luke as well, and in a certain way, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And to look at the ways within which the character who was the most marginalized, who was the most pained and who was the most judged actually is the one that holds the key for the community's survival. And I think that has really helped. Father Jerry Reynolds, God rest him, was an extraordinary redemptorist priest who has been like a grandfather to me for the last 15 years. And he died in November, very suddenly. He was 80. And he started in the mid-80s this thing called Unity Pilgrims, where from the redemptorist parish, people would go to the earliest morning mass, 8:30. And then from there, might be 10 or 12 or 15 of them would have chosen a Protestant church and they would go there as Unity Pilgrims just to be with them in worship and fellowship. And afterwards there might have been a cup of tea or something like that, but they didn't ask any more than that, simply to be welcomed. And because they did that every Sunday of the year since the mid-80s, the Clonard Unity Pilgrims are really welcomed in churches all across the city, especially places where you might have thought, God, I wouldn't have thought this place would have been a place that would have welcomed that. And his funeral, well, the funerals, there were so many services, ecumenical services and the funeral mass, etc., was just a testament to what quiet witness to peace gathered around the gospel and gathered around a hope that was about who we can be with each other rather than who we have been toward each other.
Oh, that's really beautiful.
Yeah,
what
he was
a
amazing.
Wonderful example.
I know.
Now, I wonder, are there any particular scripture passages that you have found people really particularly willing to rally around? Something that really brings people together, one marginalized character that folks from all different backgrounds can really identify with?
Yeah, well, I love the story in Luke's Gospel, often called the Good Samaritan. I tend not to like to call it the Good Samaritan because it implies, like my dad used to talk about where he worked in the university, he said, there's a Protestant woman in the office, but she's lovely. As if the rest of them aren't, but she's lovely. So I tend not to like the Good Samaritan because it kind of implies that the rest
right.
of them aren't so nice. But
judgment,
anyway, yeah. But the story of the Good Samaritan is extraordinary, not only because it's about going and doing something good, but one of the interesting things is if you were to narrate that story from the point of view of the person who was beaten up, I'm always interested in hearing what would it be like when they wake up in this inn and they say, who brought me here? And so it isn't just about giving help. It is about receiving help from unlikely corners. And the question often then is, from whom would it be difficult to receive help? And therefore, there's an ethic in receiving as well as an ethic in giving. And that shows the reciprocality. We were speaking earlier on as well about subjective and objective truth. And the words in Japanese for subjective and objective correspond to the word for host and guest. And I love that because it means that we are always host and guest to each other. And in reconciliation, what we have to do is problematize the idea of host, because host comes with power and guest comes with some kind of subservience or reception. And when it comes to reconciliation, we have to recognize that each person to the table of reconciliation has to be bringing both power as well as humility to share that with each other. And so I find the story of one of the Good Samaritans to be a really important story to tell in that
yeah.
way.
There's a vulnerability there that requires that when you are that humble, to that opens oneself up to relationship, I think. And there's a humility, I think, also on your own website, which has a little bit of information about you, about your writing, your poetry. You have quotes from Krista Tippett, the radio presenter of On Being. You have quotes from Nick Thorpe, the journalist, Martin McGuinness, Deputy First Minister, Northern Ireland Assembly, and also from your mother.
My mother. I'm delighted you saw that. Not everybody finds that
now, one. No, I have a particular affection for this one, which I'll tell you in a minute. Now, she said, so there's all these glowing quotes about your writing. It's well deserved. And then there's a quote from your mother, which says, "You're publishing a book of poetry. I won't try the brogue. That's nice, I suppose. Did you hear the woman down the road died? It was a lovely funeral, packed out."
Packed out.
And
yeah.
So there's this lovely sense of kind of going on with one's life in a sense of like, good for you. We're all trying. We're all going forward. I will say I identify because when we told my father-in-law that I was pregnant, he said, "Oh, good man," to my husband. And then he said, "Did you hear the kid up the road died?"
Oh,
right in the same breath, same exact. Yeah. There's something about, yeah. I'm not sure people in Ireland are allowed to like say something happy without leveling it out with some other sort of morbid detail.
Well, there's some linguistic factors in this. So there's this word, and it was kind of hammered into me as a child. In Irish, you'd say "na be fla huil," and "fla huil" literally translates as generosity. So "don't be generous" is what we were told. But actually, and so there's this idea of broadcasting your generosity that Irish people have an anxiety about, or broadcasting your achievement. But the word "fla huil," the etymology of it comes from the word for prince. So "don't be princely" is really what it is. And that is in the DNA of many cultures, that if you do something well, you just find a way to be calm and easy about it.
Right. Now, we have just a couple of minutes left. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your writing and the way in which sort of poetry has influenced your conflict work.
Yeah. So about 10 years ago, I was approached by the Corrymeela community, who asked would I be poet in residence for programs that brought Catholic and Protestant people together who'd been affected by the Troubles with each other, to go on journeys of dialogue, sometimes over 7 or 8 months, meeting once a week to find a way to hear each other's stories, to repeat the story of the other back to them. And I was there to listen to the stories and to respond to those stories in poetry. So one of the poems is a very short line, speaks about somebody who had spoken about only having shot at legitimate targets, and somebody else in the room said, "Well, I suppose that made me a legitimate target when I was 8 and I was shot at." And so I reflected on how legitimate target has 16 letters and one long abominable space between two dehumanizing words. So there's ways within which you try to use poetry in the silence and the space of the poetic page to make space for stories that could never be contained in words because they are so full of grief and so full of pain.
Well, I think it's wonderful. I mean, something you probably don't hear about much in this country is, you know, a place like that having a poet in residence.
Yeah.
But it strikes me as very Irish that the literary tradition is very important to your culture.
Somebody said to me the other day, "How is it that I know so many poems to quote off by heart?" And I was thinking, God almighty, because it wasn't an option. You're learning poems, yeah, a poem a week in Irish and in English from the age of 5. And I do think there is this sense in Irish culture, as well as many others too, that poetry is really part of what it means to be human, and poetry contributes to political life and to religious life and to personal life and community life.
Yeah, and I think Mary Carr writes about in her book some of the suggestions she makes in terms of like how to deal with writer's block. Like if you're really stuck, you know, try to memorize some poetry and, you know, mm-hmm. just to make it part of your writing life and your meditative life.
Yeah, no joke and total coincidence. I deal with writer's block by reading Mary Carr. She does, and it's not as if she opens up what it means to write and what it means to be true and authentic to yourselves. And I think similar to your father-in-law, Kerry, in terms of saying, "Do you know, oh, the kid up the road died," there's something about the ordinariness of sacrament, that sacrament always has to be a bit of bread, the touch of a hand to a face. Sacrament is what is truly tangible. And I think poetry and writing, especially in places of conflict, is trying to respond to that by finding what is absolutely ordinary that can convert us to our best self.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much,
Padraig. Such a pleasure.
Now, can you tell us very briefly where we can find out more information about Corrymeela?
Corrymeela.org, Corrymeela.org.
Very good. And if people stop by, they will be guaranteed a cup of tea?
Absolutely. A bucket of tea. Yeah.
A bucket of tea.
Never stops.
Perfect. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. We really, truly appreciate your time. And if folks want to learn more about America, they can go to americamagazine.org. And again, you can go to our website to find out more about that conversation, about where the church is going with Father Matt Malone and Father James Martin and myself. And it's going to be airing on Tuesday, February 2nd, 2, 4, and 9 p.m. Eastern here, as always, on Sirius XM, the Catholic channel. And you can follow America on Facebook and on Twitter and subscribe to America by calling 1-800-627-9533. So that's That's all the information that we have today on that.
Well, and I'll be back next week. You'll be off next week.
And so. I'll be, where am I going next week? I don't know. I'll be traveling. I'll be off.
Giving
but then
a talk.
You'll be back.
And I think our colleague Kevin Clark will be here. So yes. We'll get a little preview of the Pope's trip to Mexico.
Yes, indeed. I think hopefully we're sending Kevin. We're not sure yet.
Yeah.
So you'll find out next week. Little cliffhanger here. Thank you very much. I'm Carrie Weber with Tim Reedy. And good day and have a wonderful afternoon.
For listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.